Blog Talk Radio.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Creasy! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
Hello, this is Coach Chuck Creasy, and I believe Coach Hagemus, do I have you on the line?
Yeah, hey, Coach. How Coach, are you? Good to hear your voice.
I got you. You know, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe this, but you will believe it, knowing me. We have been on the air for 5 minutes here, and I had you on the mute button. Now, what in the heck is that? I'm hoping that I can go back and, you know, you listen
time,
to
I
the
just gave you my best stuff.
You gave it. That's unbelievable. I hope people can hang with this. I don't know if I can go back and edit that or what, but you know, nowadays, you know, you can forward fast and stuff, so they'll probably say, "Where in the heck is the meat on this bone?" But anyhow,
yeah.
I was doing pretty good, man. I thought maybe you know, something happened to you or something, but I really apologize. Oh my gosh. Anyhow,
okay.
Let me do my little intro real quick. Okay, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. We got Dave Hagemus on the phone, and he is on the line here on American Tennis. And I always say that I always encourage you to stand up, speak out, say what you need to say. Just address issues, not people, and nobody can find fault. Edmund Burke, all that it takes for evil to prosper, for good men to do nothing. We're going to try to address some issues today, but first, Dave, I want to give you a little hoopla here. I didn't realize you're in your 18th year or getting in your 19th year there at MIT. Which one is it?
I want to say 18th.
18th, okay. You don't even know. You're so into it. Okay.
It's a blur at this point, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Now, you know what? When I was looking at your background here, the biggest thing, I said, man, multi-versatile guy. This guy was not a city boy, I don't think, upstate New York. But do you really teach in the P classes? You know, when I first started coaching, I taught 7 academic hours. I always had to teach, we call them P classes. They call them, I think, not recreation, you know, they call them skill classes or something. I don't know, why do they call them up there with the teaching that you do? What's the official name?
Yeah, so at MIT, I mean, it's called physical education, and each student has to take at least 4 P classes to graduate, or they don't graduate.
Oh, that's great.
And they have to pass, a swim test. So, you know, I teach about 10 courses a year. I've actually started a couple courses myself. I teach everything from skating to hockey to badminton to archery. I do a self-defense class. I do an adventure class. I just try to keep it. I teach a lot besides tennis. I'll teach tennis once in a while, but I teach mostly other subjects just for fun.
Holy cow. Then I mean, no, it's really good. I miss that a lot. I used to teach racquetball, and I taught racquetball. I taught bowling, I think, one time back in my grad school days. We used to have to take dance classes. We used to have to do all that stuff, and then that gets pretty good. But that's impressive that you do that. I used to have to teach again. I'd advise students. I taught classes. We did it all. And I sort of, for the first 10 years, that's the way it was. And then in the D1 programs, of course, you want to just coaching. But that's fantastic to know all that. Dave, beside that, you were 5-time coach of the year. It says 250 wins now, 19 straight conference championships. Is that right?
Yeah. They haven't been easy. We've squeaked by on a few of those for sure, including last year.
Believe me. But here's the thing: I think you had a little bit to do also to helping Jay Lapidus. 9 ACC titles back there. I remember, we were on the back end of most of those. And all of them but one, actually. We had a good run in the 80s there, but you guys dominated ACC tennis in the 90s. And we got one win, I think, in 97, and you were the most gracious, that you could ever be. And, of course, Jay always was, too. But your journey from Duke, where you saw all the big – the major teams, top 10 teams in the country, all these players are going to go play pros. And now you're in D3. So what I'd like to do is ask you to get off and running here is, could you give the people listening, parents, now I'm thinking parents will tune in and a lot of kids, because D3 might be the purest form of tennis out there. We've played a lot of D3 schools since I've been at the Citadel. Oglethorpe, Washington Lee, Virginia Wesleyan, UT, University of Texas at Dallas, and, a lot of the D3, and it reminds me of coaching in the 80s, Dave. We didn't have any, crap going on. We didn't need referees. Yeah. For my first 10 years, we didn't have referees, Dave. We'd just say when the coach came in, the home coach was the referee, but every time somebody came to play us at Clemson, I used to say, you can be the referee if we have any problems. And you never had problems because it was sportsmanship. But talk about that, if you could, a little bit in your background. After you played D1 at Coastal Carolina, then you got to coach at Duke all those years. You've been coaching 30 years now when I was looking at this. Holy cow. But
that kind of hurts talk to about do that, but thank you.
No, I mean, that's 30 years is about 9,553 practices. I figured it out.
Yeah.
I figured it out. So anyhow, talk about that if you could. Just give a background on, I'll tell you what. Could you talk about growing up upstate New York, how you got into tennis and sort of your journey? And then if you could start talking about D3 and in the contrast in D1, okay? If you can.
Yeah.
So I'm going to sit back and listen here.
Yeah. I grew up in upstate New York, outside of the Albany area, and lots of lakes, rivers, mountains, streams, and, grew up fishing most of my life, fly fishing predominantly, and hiking, camping, et cetera, playing multiple sports. Baseball was really my sport up until I was about 13 years old. I started playing tennis right around 10 or 11-ish, with my parents. They both played and just kind of fooling around with them. And, I really wanted to be a baseball player. And, I love baseball. I was fairly good at it, but I'm just not a big guy. I'm just not, I'm a pretty thin guy naturally. And the other kids were getting bigger and stronger and, hitting the ball a little bit better than I was. And I started playing tennis, and I was fairly successful at a local level, you know, at a small-time level in my hometown, and really gravitated more and more towards tennis as I was going through my teens, and decided I would love to play in college. So, you know, took a trip down south. Upstate New York is not the greatest year-round tennis weather. You know, we do play quite a bit indoors throughout the winter, but thought it'd be great to go to school somewhere in the south, and looked at a bunch of schools, ended up at Coastal Carolina, which is right outside of Myrtle Beach, and, you know, was thinking fun and parties and everything that goes with it, and, you know, learned pretty quick that those things weren't as important as, you know, really studying and playing hard and being part of the team. And I think my last year or two there, we won our conference championship for the first time in a long time. And, you know, it was really special for me to be a part of that as a player. And what really kind of made me gravitate towards coaching was just the life lessons that I learned through tennis. Now, at Coastal, it wasn't big-time tennis. We didn't have thousands or hundreds of people even coming out to watch us. But just being on a team, working hard every day, setting goals, learning how to handle successes and failures, competing, pushing yourself, making yourself uncomfortable, all those things helped me greatly in life, helped me be successful as a student, helped me be successful as an employee or helping other people, et cetera. And I said, you know, I really want to do this. I was a phys ed major, so, you know, that's the direction I was originally going to go. And I said, you know, I just want to be a PE teacher and help kids out and have fun and, you know, make kids fitter and athletic and go towards that lifestyle. A couple years after Coastal, maybe one or two, I tried to play, you know, briefly on the satellite tour back then and quickly learned that I was going to make it.
Well, you got good pretty quick if you started late. I mean, you what I like, yeah. You started at the park, just like me. I tell people that Dr. Sid E. Parks was my coach, and I tell people I played for the three drugs I got at the park. You want to hear this one?
Yeah, sure.
Three drugs. I got dopamine, adrenaline, and endorphins at the park playing tennis. You know, those were the. Yeah. It wasn't about. I just, you know, you love the sport, but you started at the park. Yeah. But how did you make such a jump? Did anybody help you out? I mean, parents out there now are spending lots of money, sending their kids to academies, trying to keep up with the Joneses and everything. But you were upstate New York. It probably benefited you to not know how hard things were. Is that true or is that accurate?
Exceptionally true. And, you know, I did start late. And, again, if I was going to script a junior player now and say, okay, here's your path to the pro level, it would not have been the level, you know, the script that I took, right, the path I took. We just didn't know any better. We didn't have quality coaching. I had coaches throughout my junior career. But like you, when I was 13 or 14, maybe even 12, my mother or father would drop me off at the park at 9 a.m. on their way to work, and they would pick me up at 4 or 5 p.m. when they were coming home.
Same.
I just stayed at a public park in Troy, played anybody and everybody from, you know, older guys, older women, younger kids, whatever. We just stayed there all day and played anybody and anyone. Which is really great. I mean, it was a great experience. It taught me a lot. You know, definitely playing with older players taught you how to behave on the court, how to, you know, play smarter, construct points, et cetera. So, I did the same thing. I think when I was about 15, 16, maybe I gravitated more towards, you know, certain coaches that kind of helped me and groom me. But it was, you know, by then, you know, maybe it was too late for me to really take my game to the higher, you know, the higher national level. So, you know, I was basically just a well-rounded.
But you didn't know any better.
I didn't know any better. And, you know, in a way, it's a blessing. I mean, sometimes I feel bad for kids today. To be successful, you got to focus on one sport early on, get quality coaching, you know, and invest all your eggs in one basket and playing that one sport if you're going to have any kind of chance to play at a high college level or beyond, right? And it's tough because they never really just get to play other sports or take it for fun, you know.
This makes me want to jump in here. Okay, Dave, if somebody's told you, okay, Hagemus, your UTR is a 7.6, and you need to have a 10.9 to be in college to play. Seriously. I mean, there's a saying in coaching that I told somebody recently is that you try to keep fog on top of the mountain till the kids are too high up to turn back. You never let people know how hard things are. If you do, kids, you know, adults want all of the information, but kids, it's crazy. But you kept your light on with the tennis, so you played all the tournaments and stuff. And then how exactly did you? What was the connection to Coastal Carolina? By the way, they've got a real good team now, you know. Good friend Jody Hyden went there. Was Jody on your team back then, Jody Hyden?
Yeah, so Jody was my teammate. He was my teammate, my roommate.
Oh my!
And that's how I got into coaching. So,
his story is almost identical. He's from West Virginia. Yeah. He said he went to a school or something and only had like 18 seniors or something, and he played every sport.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for me. Ended up at Coastal, it was really coming from the north and just looking for warmer weather and someplace fun to go to school. At that point, I wanted to play tennis and really invest into tennis and see how far I could go. Coastal seemed like a great place to do that. And that's where I met Jody. So Jody was on my team and, you know, we had a great experience and a bunch of other great guys on the team as well. After Coastal, again, I, you know, dabbled playing tournaments and work in different places and trying to be competitive on the satellite circuit. Didn't pan out. And Jody at the time was actually working for the women's team at Duke. So I believe the coach he was working for was Jane Pryor at the time. So I used to go up there and just practice with them periodically. I was still playing quite a bit. And whenever I went up there, Jane or Jody would say, hey, jump on the court with, you know, so-and-so. And I would hit with a lot of the women on the team there, and it was great. And he ended up leaving and going to Clemson the following year, and he helped me get his position there. So I ended up working for Coach Jeff McDonald, who I believe is at Vanderbilt. I know he's there for some time.
I've got to get him on there. He's done a long time. So he was on Virginia's team, I can remember, back, back in the late 70s, so. What a great career he's had. So.
Yeah, he was a great player. He did some good things at UVA, and then he came to Duke, and he did some great things at Duke. He ended up going to Vanderbilt. But I was with Jeff for 1 year, so I was with him for one season. And during that time, Jay and I, Jay Lapidus and I, became pretty good friends. And, you know, we had some conversations over the summer, and I said, listen, you know, his assistant coach had just left, and he said, man, I don't know how to do this, but I would really love to have you come to the men's team. And I was like, you know, I got to be honest with you. I'd love to work for you. And just you as a person, I, you know, honor and respect. And we had a lot of fun, and we had a great chemistry and connection. And anyway, I ended up jumping from the women's team to the men's team. And it worked out well. And I was with Jay for, you know, close to 10 years. As you know, we won 9 out of
tremendous,
ACC championships. I believe, you know, I remember your victory and your Clemson team, you know, victory at that time that took us out 1 year, which was awesome. We had an amazing rivalry with yourself and Clemson and UNC at the time. We had some amazing rivalries and, you know, Wake was getting better, you know, some of those schools. You know, the conference has changed, right? So UVA at the time was a weaker team, but they were getting stronger, and players like Brian Vahaley did an amazing job, and Huntley Austin, I think, came in at some point, and they kind of changed that program around. NC State was getting a little bit better. You know, the conference on the whole was gaining, you know, popularity and getting stronger. Georgia Tech had some good teams, Florida State. We had an amazing run there. I had a unbelievable opportunity to not only work with and be a part of Jay's program. We had, you know, so many successful players that came in and out of there. We got to play, you know, the greatest teams in Division I at the time, the California schools, the Texas schools, the Florida schools, yourself, you know, the ACC, Notre Dame, you know, the list goes on, and Illinois, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it was really an amazing experience. During that time, I got married, had a daughter. I had an adoptive son who, you know, still has family in that area. So it was tough to move on from there. I was kind of stuck in the Raleigh-Durham area for a while. And for me to pursue a Division I coaching experience, it would have had to be a local school at the time. So you're talking NC State, UNC, maybe Wake. So some of these schools weren't opening up. You know, obviously Coach Paul is still at UNC. We actually talk once in a while, and, you know, he's done some amazing things there. As you know, it's very difficult to get a job in the Division I world, very difficult. You know, there's only a few jobs that open up each year to competition, and qualifications of guys going for those jobs are extremely difficult, you know, are strong. So it was tough. I had an opportunity. Things changed in our ability to leave the area. And at that point, you know, as an assistant back then, you weren't making any money. Like, you just weren't making. I think my initial salary at Duke was about $9,000.
It was room, board, and experience. You don't have to tell anybody. It was when we first started out, we got room, board, and experience.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was the way it was with coaches,
I think I made $9,000. I think my, you know, after a few years, I worked my way up to $12,000. Possibly 15, and I thought I was the richest guy on the planet. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm rich. I'm making 12 grand. So you did it for the love of it, right? You did it for the experience. You did it to build your resume, hopefully parlay that resume into a good opportunity or coaching opportunity down the road. So eventually what happened was I had a daughter, had a wife, had a son, and I had an opportunity to do some private coaching in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it was a private, you know, family who had their own court. They had a couple of their kids were playing competitive tournaments, et cetera. And the pay for me at the time was extraordinary. You know, it was like, you know, oh my gosh, that's absolutely amazing. My wife could stay home with my children, and, you know, we could kind of have a normal life. So that's the route I chose, and I've got into it about a year and a half, and this was a difficult situation at the time. So it wasn't everything that I imagined it to be, nor did I imagine it would be a long-term commitment. So I quickly was trying to get back into the game of coaching and into college athletics. And, you know, college athletics has a very short memory. Once you leave and your name's no longer circulated around, it's really tough to get back in. It's not an easy jump. Unless you're a big name former pro player, it's tough. And it wasn't easy. So my situation, you know, kind of forced me to make a quick choice. Coach Bobby Bayless was at Notre Dame, and he was kind of a
– That's what I was thinking. Yeah, he was right before you, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was originally at MIT, and Bobby's been a great mentor, you know, to a lot of young coaches, and myself included. So, you know, I used to go to him for advice. He was always great about making calls for you, you know, backing you for certain jobs if he felt it was a good fit for you, you know, et cetera. So anyway, I was talking to Bobby one day. I said, hey, did you ever think about MIT? They're opening right now. He actually coached there at some point years before Notre Dame. Yeah, and he said, listen, I didn't even know what D3 schools were. I was like, MIT? I was like, of course I heard of MIT. I mean, who hasn't? But I didn't know anything about your athletic programs or Division III in general at all. He said, listen, you really need to take a look at this. He said, I think it's one of the best jobs in the country, period. I said, really? He goes, absolutely. He said, take a look at it. So I interviewed for it, ended up getting an offer, and, you know, after some lengthy conversations with different people, I ended up taking the position. So I get there at MIT. It's a Division III. You know, it's a different world from Division I. And, you know,
well, the thing is, though, I'm thinking, I would hate to jump, let me jump in there real quick, but
yeah.
You'd been at Duke, which was extremely,
yeah.
You know, high academics, high expectation academics, and a lot of the, yeah. I'm thinking a lot of the students pretty much were similar, you know, and, I mean, that pretty much prepared you, and then you're around Jay Lapidus, you know,
yeah.
And you understood what winning was about and, the, you know, how to motivate them, so... But yeah, go ahead and talk about the differences, though, in the D3 and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, academically it was similar. You know, a lot of our athletes at Duke were great guys. They did well, successful, you know, high national level kids coming out and did well in college as well. The kids in MIT are good players, and the way I kind of tell my D1 friends is that if you took a top 25 or top, you know, 30 or so Division I schools, and you took like their maybe their 5 through 7 guys, you know,
yeah,
the bottom
yeah.
part of the lineup,
yeah.
those guys are the best guys in D3. Like, it's good tennis. It's really good quality tennis. They might not have the big cannon serves, big, you know, they might not have the big games that the top guys in D1 do, but it's really good, solid tennis. I would equate the best guys in D3 could play 5 or 6 for most D1 schools.
I would completely agree.
Yeah.
I'd completely agree.
And then a lot of the D1 programs, the better D1 or D3 programs, could probably beat a lot of D1 schools from, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, 75 down or even 50 to 75, I think they'd have
yeah.
their hands full with a lot of D3 schools. They're very deep. They're very strong. You know, these are top-level kids that are being recruited. I mean, you know, if we're getting kids maybe in tennis recruiting, if you go that route, you know, maybe 50 to 150. You know, these are good quality kids. Every once in a while we get a kid, you know, in the top 25 or even – you know, a rare blue chipper here or there. So it's good, you know, it's high-level tennis. These kids, the difference is between the D1 kids is these kids don't have any desire to play pro or really are going that. They're really seeking a balance between academics. Academics 100% comes first. Athletics is something they've done their whole life. They still want to play athletics. They still want to be part of a team and, you know, maybe win a championship or become an All-American or et cetera. But they've kind of foregone the dreams and fantasies of playing pro tennis. They just want to play for fun. Doesn't mean they don't compete just as hard. You know,
no, no.
Yeah.
No, let me jump in real quick there. Listen, every match I've had against D3, I think probably in my tenure here, I've already been here 10 years, Dave, you can believe that. But
yeah,
in those 10 years, we've probably played 15 to 20 D3 schools, and I love it. It's a great, great experience. Use traditional scoring. Nobody, the sportsmanship was above board. Every kid, I can't remember one kid ever tanking, not one. And they just, they love the sport of tennis. And it's quite, I hate to say this, but disgusting what is going on in some of the college D1 matches with the NOAAD scoring, and the cheating is unbelievable on game points. You know, it's over the top because it's an 8-point swing. But contrast that. Talk about D3 a little bit about more. Talk about it more about your format and your great experiences you've had. You've had lots of conference championship teams. And I know you've had some close goes, but man, you've got. I mean, come on. I'm looking here. You 19 straight conference championships, and then you had 9. You've had all you've done is win, man. Since you've been a coach as assistant, you know, you might have only maybe we gave you the only loss ever. You know, there at Duke.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, we when Lapidus, let me tell you just real quick about Lapidus, what I you know, of course I knew him when he was at Princeton and what kind of competitor he was. But coaching against him, you know, we did not like losing. You know, it hurt bad.
Yeah.
We had some good runs. But then when Lapidus never, ever, ever rubbed it in. He never, ever put his own billboard out there, and they never flaunted. And that, by the way, that made it harder to beat you guys at Duke, because you just did things in a classy way. And, you know, so it wasn't like we stopped trying. You know, I blamed it on all those stupid rules that they wouldn't let us practice anymore after 1992. They put in all those restrictions, shortened the season, shortened practice hours, holy cow, we never used to go on the clock. We used to just go to practice and say, hey, we're going to leave when we get this right. And that was a good way of doing stuff, I think. But anyhow, thanks to you guys for the way you guys always handled everything. And Jay, it was bittersweet, you know, when you'd lose to you guys. Bittersweet it was. But anyhow,
Jay did an amazing job. I mean, he was a workhorse. He really emphasized hard work is going to eventually, you know, get you to the end and make you the most successful you can be. We also, you know, what you're talking about, we also had many conversations, and this was a conscious decision on our part, is listen, when you win, you put your head down, you shake hands, and you walk off the court. If you lose, you put your head down, you shake hands, you walk off the court. And I don't mean put your head down, sulking. You know, you look the person in the eye, but you don't celebrate. You never run in a victory.
Never.
Because almost 100% of the time, it's going to come back and haunt you. And all you're doing is fueling the fire of your competitors. All you're doing is fueling the fire for them to work twice as hard and want nothing more to beat you the next time you play. If you take that off the table and you win and you do it with class and composure, you kind of pull that fire from your competitors. You know,
That's right.
They still want to beat you. Of course they do. But they don't have that extra
You never poke a sleeping bear is what I tell the guys. You never poke a sleeping bear. I said, I don't want my guys. I said, if you win the NCAAs one year, you're allowed to storm the court. I don't want to see any of that crap. I said, be humble. Act like you've done it before. No dances in the end zone. Be like Herschel Walker. Yep. Act like you've done it before. You know?
That's right.
But, you know, so,
and,
you know.
And that's That's one of the – I mean, you just hit the nail on the head. If you win and if you go crazy, like it's the greatest thing that's ever happened, a victory, what you're telling your opponent is that you didn't really believe you could win. It was a fluke.
Right.
You played even above your own expectations. But if you win and you walk up very calm and confident, you don't celebrate, and it's like, damn, that kid, he knew he was going to beat me. He was confident the whole time. Whether you
were or
you weren't, the confidence that it gives you and the look that your opponent's going to have if you just calmly and securely – is going to have more damage on their psyche down the road than if you celebrate. So, you know, we've always done that. You know, as part of the 19 championships we've won at MIT. Again, they haven't been easy, all of them. I mean, they've been very
winning's hard, man. Winning's hard.
Yeah, winning's hard.
But
it's hard because everybody's gunning for you. Everybody's
okay, so at MIT, you've never lost.
Yeah.
And then here we go at Duke. You win 9 at Duke. Come on, man. You win 28, 29. Holy cow.
Yeah.
That ain't bad,
you know,
Bubba.
Chuck, I hate to lose. I hate to lose more than I like to win. You know, I got to be honest. Winning's great. It's fun, whatever. It doesn't excite me, but losing,
no.
Man, it hurts. I just can't.
I'm
not a good loser.
It hurts for a day and a half, man. It still hurts for a day and a half.
Yeah. I'm not a good loser. losing things way more is way harder than uni.
It does. It does. So, yeah. Well, listen, I want to move on here a little bit.
Yeah.
And again, just say no comment if you don't want to go there. But recently, the ITA, okay, now you got to understand, I was in the room in 1977 in Corpus Christi, Texas, when the dues was $10 a year. We had 36 coaches in there. And old Coach Dan McGill helped push through the no-ad scoring for a one-year trial. It passed 19-17. One-year trial. Well, we had to use it for those years in the 80s. But little by little, listen to subtleties. I had a player named Richard Matuszewski who lost to a guy. I think it was Jeff Kleparta. I think it was Kleparta. If he's listening, I think it's right. He beat Richard 0-0 out in California, but Richard lost 5.3 all games. And then Richard played him later at the NCAA tournament and won a match.
Right.
You know, and we had Lawson Duncan beat Pernfors pretty easy, 2-2. Lost about a month later at finals NCAAs, 1-4. Right. And there were so many good players, I started going, whoa, that guy, he's had 10 losses this year. I didn't realize that. He's too good for that. He wouldn't have lost in regular scoring. But anyhow, long story short, a lot of players took hits they shouldn't hit. And then for 15 years we had – Paul Scarpa stood up at a coach's meeting one time and the three doubles, eight-game pro sets and full matches and everything. And we got back – I think the USTA actually stepped in. The former head, David Markin, stepped in. He said to me one time, they're not even playing the rules of tennis. This isn't a rule of tennis, no ad scoring. And so the bottom line on the thing is they got it out of there for 15 years. But the last 15 years, I've watched this so closely, but we used to have these coaches. I wasn't even coaching before I came back into college coaching, Dave. These coaches, they were in meetings, and they were sort of plotting about how they could get no ad back. I said, you guys don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. So you don't want to abbreviate. If you abbreviate, you're not going to get the real winners, and you're going to destroy the fabric of the sport. I've always used a baseball analogy. I say, guys,
still there?
How would it be if it's full count in baseball and then you only get one more pitch? In other words, if you don't get a hit, you go to the dugouts and out. Okay, would that change baseball? It would change the whole dynamic, and there's so much more. But I used to argue these things, and these guys kept pushing. And I said, what in the world are they doing? And then, of course, the fiasco of all of the ITA meetings, Dave, that we went to, we voted it down 5 times in one form or another. But the catalyst where they went haywire in basically, I'm going to say the ITA, you hijacked college tennis. You would not exist, ITA, if it were not for the sweat and the work of college coaches. And we would not exist if college coaches would not cave in and side in with your shenanigans, what they did. But how they did it was politically the way you do so many things. They bled it in. At first they got voted down, and the guy who was the head of it, I'm not going to use his name, but he was the head of it. He was an Ivy League guy. But he basically, after we had a straw vote, was what he called it, but I called it a real vote because we had about 40 coaches there, and it was passed that we stay with traditional scoring because they'd try this two-ad system. We called it the Bullwinkle system. It was so stupid, you know. And anyhow, when I was on the way home, one of the coaches called me and said, you won't believe, they went behind closed doors, and they said, look, we can do whatever we want to do. This was a straw vote. And, you know, so they voted it down, but they pushed and pushed and pushed. So the long story short is I've always wondered if we had our best players in the world, Dave, if we had Djokovic, Federer, the old school Rod Laver and somebody, and they said, we're going to change the scoring system of tennis, wouldn't we say to them, well, that's pretty arrogant. What gives you the right to change 150 years of tradition? Wouldn't this make every success coming up something we'd have to put an asterisk next to, like a win-dated win or a this was a, an abbreviated scoring. It cannot be equal if someone wins Wimbledon one day by winning tiebreaker sets or, excuse me, no ad scoring, 2 out of 3 sets. It cannot compare to a 5-set victory that are the greatest matches in history. Likewise, in tennis, you cannot compare a no-ad victory with those we had that were 5-set matches. For example, the I can remember back 3 out of 5 sets, Kevin Curran beating Eric Kaskirski, I think, in 4 sets, you know, there in Kalamazoo, 5 sets. 3-set is not the same. So the point being is that I believe they hijacked college tennis, the ITA did, and their goal is this, folks. Listen, if you're a junior tennis parent, their goal was to get college tennis, push it into the juniors, and then in 5 or 6 years from now, you know, those players may be in the pros. Hopefully they're not, because most of it's international pretty much now, but those that get in there, and then they, if they can bleed it in enough, people won't argue. And I believe it's done for monetary reasons, and I'm not, that's all I'm going to leave there. I believe it's done for monetary reasons. I believe there could have been quid pro quo going on. They did not. Okay, with that all being said about the overreach and the long battle, okay, let me ask you this question. Was the hijacking a college tent? Do you think that they're pushing it into D3 for the welfare of your student-athletes, Dave?
No. I mean, well, if they are, they're very short-sighted. I mean, here's my whole take on the no-ad situation. I mean, obviously D1 has been doing it for some time, and they keep shortening their format. I think last year I went to watch Harvard and Stanford play at Harvard in round of maybe 16 or 32 of the NCAAs. And, you know, Coach Rube has done an amazing job at Harvard, and they had a great team, and Stanford comes over, and I said, man, I'm going to go watch this. You know, Paul Goldstein is now at Stanford. I remember competing, you know, against him when I was at Duke. So it was really fun for me to watch. I couldn't believe how quickly doubles was over. Now, we play some D1 schools, you know, throughout the year, some local D1 schools, and we have a lot of fun with them, and we've done different formats. But I couldn't believe how quickly doubles was over. I mean, no way
it's a joke.
That. Was over. It was over in the blink of an eye. And then, you know, the singles, I mean, bottom line for me is no air scoring is ruining the game, in my opinion. It's ruining the game.
Absolutely.
And to me, you know, I would love to hear more about your incent, you know, what you're thinking. Maybe you're thinking, you know, DraftKings and some of the betting world wants no ad.
I am thinking that way, because, Dave, why would people fight for something so abstract? Nobody fights for 15 years in an organized fashion to do something that's so abstract. To get it on TV is what they used to say. And my argument was, well, if you're on TV, we'll do a hokey pokey show. But it's not to get it on TV. That's a red herring. That was crap. So it's not for that reason. So I believe there's something behind it. Wanting their goal, though, Dave, their goal is for random results. Where do random results, who makes a profit off of random results? Do they want Federer or Nadal winning 11 straight, you know, French Opens? Do they want that, or would they want something much more random? By the way, look at our other sports. Football games, now we have games that are 55-40 instead of 17-14. And basketball, three-point shots, 24 seconds, a run up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. There's no set offenses. There's no baseball. Are they juicing the balls? Are they juicing the balls? I sure don't want the bad guys coming after me or something like that. But we need to stand up and say something about this, because it's crap. What they're doing to the kids in junior tennis, sure enough, in junior tennis now they tell kids, oh, you want to play the college system? Really? That's the college system? You mean it gets to be more polluted and diluted and prostituted? You know, I mean, oh, we're going to play, they play in these junior tournaments where they play one set for the doubles. I mean, yeah. What a joke. In college, it's such a joke. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is a joke. I played no way myself 1 or 2 years when I was at Coastal. I think they tried it back then as an experimental thing. So it's just a different, drastically different game, mentally and even physically. If I come down to like what I really think the true reasons are, and I'm not saying your reason isn't correct because it very well may be, but I think most coaches are sold a lie, thinking that A, the team that they can never beat now playing no ads going to give them maybe a little bit more of an advantage to beat those better teams. I think that's a lie. I think it's detrimental to
absolutely
the progress as players. I also think that they think, which is also not true, that it's going to be that drastically shorter, and they don't want to be out there for 3 or 4 hours or whatever a match may take. But you know what?
So they're lazier. You're saying most coaches are lazier?
I'm saying there's a lot of coaches.
I can say it. Hey, I'm saying, look, yeah, coaches, it's easy way out.
Yeah.
If you're lazier, you're destroying the game. But here's, look, Dave, you can remember matches in your career that everybody remembers matches like 1980 McEnroe-Borg. Everybody remembers those five-set great matches, you know, the great Australian Open finals. Dave, I had a match, a difference maker in high school. I won 8-6, 3-6, 20-18 in a high school match in 1968.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And that was a difference maker for my whole – I remember it 50 years later. And our kids – but if you win no ad, especially with that stupid tiebreaker for the third set, when you win, it's like kissing Aunt Sally. It's not really a kiss. You know, it's like guys win, and it's not a rite of passage. And if you lose, Dave, if you lose, it doesn't hurt enough to where you want you suffer and say, I got to get better. Because it's when you lose in a tough, tough 7-5 in the third, it's decision time. I either engage and get a little bit better, and tennis would reward you if you did the work. It does not reward you now. So people are taking shortcuts. You know, it doesn't punish you either if you lose a tight match. Every breakthrough, John Isner broke through at D.C., won 7-5 in the third, 6-6, 4 in the third, and all of a sudden he was on the map. You know, but every player breaks through. They don't break through by winning 2-2, no ad. No. No player breaks through when they win a tiebreaker for the third, for sure. So, okay, that's go ahead.
I think the fundamental flaw that coaches make is that the game was somehow broken and they needed to fix it or change it. The game's not broken. The game is what it is. It's never going to be basketball. It's never going to be over in a set period of time. It's not the sport. I've been at Georgia where they've had 5,000 people in the stands barking like bulldogs and with regular scoring, and matches taking a long time. And it was, you know, some of the greatest tennis environments I've ever seen. You know, other places have had similar environments. The game is not broken. To think that you can shorten the game to get it on TV and it's going to become basketball or football, it's not.
No.
It's not going to happen. And that's one fallacy. The second fallacy, or the second incentive I think a lot of these coaches have is like, yeah, they just want to get the match over, either get the win or loss and move on and go home. Well, they're in it for the wrong reason. You shouldn't be coaching that. It's not about you anymore. Once you know, one of the greatest lessons I ever learned was actually from you. And, you know, you're talking about Lawson Duncan and Jay Berger and Matuszewski and all these great players that you help, you know, have good pro careers. And you've done an amazing, you know, if you look at your record, you know, you could put it on par with any coach that's ever coached college tennis. And I don't know how many people actually realize that, you know, what effect you had on college tennis and what great players you helped push into, you know, not only great coach playing careers, but also coaching careers. But I was down at Clemson 1 year, and I was at Duke, and we were technically your enemy. I mean, we were a big rival. We were winning. You didn't want anything to do. I was there visiting Jody, and we were hanging out, and you had this a doctor. I think it was Dr. Bryce Young, if I actually remember correctly. And he was doing a sports psych talk with your team. And you looked outside, and you said, "Hey, Dave, I want you to come in here." And I said, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, I want you in. I want you to be part of this too. Hey, we're all in this to help the kids and make the kids better." And I tell you what, I never forgot that, because you had these, you had him in there to make your team better and to probably beat us at the time and beat the other schools. And you took the enemy in me, and you said, "You know, I want you to come in here too. You saw the bigger picture. We're in this for the kids. What can we do to make the kids better? Your kids, my kids. Let's make American tennis our kids better." And I always kept that philosophy. Coaching should not be about you. It has to be about the kids. You have to put them first. Don't shorten the format. These tournament directors that run these junior tournaments that are so short and abbreviated, it's disgusting. It's not the sport anymore. You're losing kids left and right because they want to collect a paycheck, make money, and then run off and go home. They're
it's
in it
terrible.
For the wrong reason. What I'm noticing,
I went to a junior tournament, Hilton Head, a couple of weeks ago. There's no passion in the kids.
Yeah.
The USTA top-down management is screwed up because Tim Wilkerson made this great statement. He said, "Kids don't play for points. They play for tournaments of heritage and rivalries." What we've done, we've taken those away, the rivalries away because of the points, and the tournaments of heritage. I asked the guy, I said, "Why do we, well, this is the level 4 Southern Blue Group, what the heck is this event?" Kids are losing their passion, and it's terrible. Yeah. But, you know, the thing about drawing crowds to, I believe that was a red herring. Now, if you think about every sport, Dave, is that football has a national following. You could have University of Texas. Yeah. People will follow it. They will go there. Basketball has maybe a two-hour regional following. Baseball, maybe people would drive an hour for a baseball game. But let's face it, any of the minor sports, the non-revenue sports, you've either got to have a parent or somebody that's maybe on campus or somebody within 5 to 10 minutes that's local. You know, that's the way it is. But so that's a big red herring. But that's why I think this whole effort was organized. I really do. And also, early on, I talked to a coach who was working for the USTA. I said, "What are they doing?" He said, "Oh, don't even argue that one, Creasy." It really upset me. He goes, "Creasy, don't even argue that one. That bus has left the station, or train has left the station already. It's going to be no ad." Ha, 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 ha. He went like that to me. I go, "Whoa, he knows something I don't know." Also, when I was on the National Tennis Junior Committee, I tried to put some things forward, and there was some opposition. A lot of people understood what we were trying to do, protect the history and the heritage of the game. But some of the higher-ups, that's why I believe there's an agenda. I believe there's a big brother there or a deep state of tennis that's trying to push this. You know, marketing people. Go ahead. Sorry. Go.
No, you're spot on. And to be honest with you, I've never really been involved in the politics of tennis. I kind of just do my job, worry about my kids and, you know, my conference and et cetera, teams that we play. But I never really got into the politics. I did, like yourself, when I was at Duke, sit in on some of these meetings at the end of the year where coaches are doing straw votes, and seen some amazing things come out of there that are kind of baffling, in the sense that, you know, you had a really small sample size of coaches that happen to be typically at these conventions. They typically happen to be like at the end of the NCAAs, when they used to do it in Division I a long time ago. And it was basically the top team dictating what everybody else.
Are you telling me it looked fixed? It looked rigged? Are you telling me that?
Well, I think
it looked rigged.
You know,
did it?
About,
they always did.
Well, we talked about pecking order, right? So what the top teams do, the other coaches kind of follow suit. because they think, ooh, that must be they know what they're doing, and we're just going to follow
right.
suit and go with it because they know
that's
a lot
right.
more than I do.
They
so
politically,
who am I to question, right? And I think a lot of coaches go along to get along, and it's just not the right way to go. I mean, the majority of the coaches in college, whether it's D1, D2, or D3, the coaches outside of the top teams really have more power and say than the top school, than the top teams. Even though the top teams coaches typically have the loudest voices, the power really is in the masses, in the numbers, not the tip of the pyramid.
If they're well educated to what the thing is, the truth, and you know, and that's the point. These political things, first of all, the ITA hijacked college tennis. They have no right to be pushing all the coaches around. Tell me what the ITA, look, I work for my school, my conference, and the NCAA. The ITA has no jurisdiction. It has no jurisdiction over your school. So, I mean, why are they pushing this forward? Why are the coaches collapsing? Why are the coaches not rebellious? I want to say one last thing. We've got about 3 minutes here, Dave. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, with their push that they've had for the last 10 to 15 years, if it was really a good thing, do you think all of the coaches by now, don't you think they would have bought into it by now? Said, wow, this is really good. Okay? There's a reason why it was pushed out after it was used in the 80s when nobody knew about it.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, coaches would be going, whoa, whoa, this is great. This is great for the game. They're not. They're tolerating it at best. Am I right or not?
Yeah, they're tolerating it. I would love to know how they truly feel about it. I really would, because everybody I talk to person is like, you know, I think a lot of coaches want the shorter system because they just want to get out of there. They really just want to get out of there and go home. Now, I'm not saying that across the board, just the small sample that I see. The coaches that are really against no ad scoring, and I'm one of them for sure, I have no fear of saying it. I think it's a bad system. I think it's bad for the game of tennis. I think it's bad for the development of our players. I think it's not how the game was designed. It not only changes how they play, but the speed they play, mentally how they, you know, play each point.
Everything.
Yeah. I I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of it, but I think a lot of coaches say, hey, if it speeds up the game, everybody has to do it. Let's just do it and get it over with and get out of here.
Well, nobody understands, the subtleties, though. I mean, it's as simple as having to win 3 points in a row. If you don't know how to win 3 points in a row in regular tennis, which is called a conversion, you'll never be good. If you don't win the first point of the game, you have to win 3 in a row or 4 out of 5. All right?
Right.
All you got to do is no ad is win one. All right? And
right.
think about the,
right.
how the, if you get the 31st, if you get 30 love, you have 16-1 odds of winning that game or having game point. 16, you just got to win 1/2 times 1/2 times 1/2. Look at me. I just had a, you know, I'm not an MIT guy, and I figured that out. But 30-15 is an 8-1. 30-15 is 8-1. Instead of tying it up, the brilliance of the game is this, Dave. Game point is now going to be an 8-point swing. And people don't understand this. So here's the analogy I use. If at four, well, first of all, at 4-4, it's easy to see. If you win on a let court or the cheating's unbelievable because the game point is worth 8. In the old days, nobody would cheat you when it was their own game point to win a game. They'd want to be a cheater to win. But they might cheat to prevent you from game point. But the point is if you win and go up 5-4, you need 4. The other person needs 12. First game of the match, if you win that game, it's going to take you 8 points to overcome the one game lead you would have had to get back.
Yeah.
So people don't see that, and that's why our traditional scoring is so brilliant. That's why you're able to work on the efficiency of a server. You can take him in no ad scoring. He needs 4 points, and he's never going to play more than 7 points. Could you imagine a pitcher in baseball never having to throw more than 6 pitches after a full count?
Yeah.
Never has to throw six pitches. Six pitches per most 18 for three outs. Most. You never. And so these things, it's ludicrous. And then that let cord rule, we only did that because there were two players that were pretty good players on high on the national scene. And I'm not going to say their names. They used to cheat every time they got ace. They'd call let. That's ridiculous. Instead of disciplining them, we do that. It's the stupidest thing ever.
I was in the meeting when they took a vote on that. And talking to the coaches, I was in the D1 world at the time. That was the impetus behind the no-let rule, was that guys were cheating on a big serve as an ace, and all they had to do was say let. And I don't think a lot of people understand the history of that, why that rule was implemented. But that was the initial push of why that rule was implemented. The other reason I think coaches backed the no-add design is that they think it gives them a little bit of an advantage against the better teams, right? It says, hey, you know, maybe we get one more break of serve. Maybe it's easier to break. They think it's going to allow them to get one upset, a little bit of an advantage or a greater advantage to get an upset against a top team or a better team that they're typically not beating. And I think a lot of coaches are falling prey to that. Like, hey, it might help us a little bit, give us that little bit of an advantage that we can beat some of these teams that we're typically not beating. But again, at the detriment of the players, you know, learning the game and playing the game the way it should be played. So, again, they're putting their wins, you know, or potential wins over what's best for the players in the long run.
This is very quick, and I'm going to leave that because we only got about 45 seconds. But if you were playing basketball, folks out there, listen, what if a missed shot counted 16 points in basketball? Would that be ridiculous? Okay, here's where I'm going with this. We have the only sport that when you miss a ball, okay, I get the point. In basketball, could you imagine? I'd like to try that in basketball coaching someday. My team, if you miss, it'd clean up shot selection, that's for sure, instead of the stupid stuff we see in the NBA. But anyhow, could you imagine you miss, the other team gets the point. That's a 2 points, that's a 4-point swing. But make it an 8-point swing. When the red light goes on, it's an 8-point swing. It's 16-point swing. That's what you're talking about. Yeah. It's ludicrous. Yeah. An 8-point swing in tennis is ludicrous on a let cord, cheating, luck, whatever. Tennis would always even out because you got to beat a person by two. You know, so anyhow, Dave, one last, I'm going to give you the last word there, man. It's about time to go, but anything else? You got just thank you. Thank you for the friendship. Thank you for all you do for young people, and keep up the good fight, man. Battle this stuff.
I appreciate you, Chuck. And, you know, you've done so much for me throughout my career, and just learning from you and being able to compete against you and other great coaches in the game has, just gave me incredible insight on what it takes to develop the player and put the player first, put their development first, what they learn on the team and competing, and how they can use those lessons in life is the greatest thing for athletics and sports. That should be the greatest focus and goal.
Without a doubt.
The best of luck. Great chatting with you.
Hey, 28 conference championships. Love it. Love it. Hey, God bless you, man. You take care of your family. And give my best to Jay when you talk to him, and I'll say hi to Jody for you. And, keep up the battle, man. Okay, we'll see you.
God bless. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Amen. Bye.
That's about it, folks. We will see you next time. You're in the process of winning or losing every day of life, and has very little to do with a win or a loss. Coach Chuck Creasy. See you next week. King James and Uncle Sam. He's got the red, white, blue, flying high on a farm. Number 5 tattooed on his left arm. Spend a little more in the store for a tag in the back of this. Come.